Shauna Anderson, archaeobotanist and ethnobotanist, and working for Plant Life.
Yes. Should I plug myself in or just hold it? First of all, I just want to say thank you to Piers and Francois for inviting me. When I was an academic waif and stray, Scott Poehler took me in and gave me external supervision in my PhD, so it's very nice to be back here after 10 or 12 years. So I'd like to say that. What I'll say about my talk today is this is a personal experience. This is not a unified academic view of what culture is in conservation, or even a unified view of what plant life thinks about culture and conservation. This is my personal experience of being a participant in science-based conservation and the ideas and thoughts that I have around that. So that's where I'm coming from on this. So I just want to very briefly talk about some of the frameworks that I work in on a professional level. I want to look at some examples of where I think that we could do something different or something slightly different in culture. And I want to look at a project I've been working on for the last 2 or 3 years called Wildflower Europe. So my colleagues and I, on a daily basis, this is what we do a lot of. We do lots of counting and measuring and assessing change. We red list things, we say there's more of this, there's less of this, this is going up, this is going down, on a variety of levels and scales. It's not the only thing we do, but it's a key element of what we do, and it's a key element of what we tell people about what we do. And we're not the only conservation organisation. Most major mainstream conservation organisations are very numbers-based. We also do policy, we do outreach, we do management advice and direct conservation, but that's the part I'm talking about. For the first 5 years of working at Plant Life, I spent a long time working with groups of scientists, politicians and ministries, trying to get them to identify important plant areas, making decisions about where the best sites for plants were. And after 5 years of working that system, I think for me it came down to finding the perfect equation. That's what people wanted to do. They wanted to sit in a room for months, years, decades and find the perfect equation. And the underlying thought behind that was, if only we can perfect the criteria or refine our criteria to identify our threatened species, habitats, other people will be so convinced by the power of our argument, they'll set aside their own priorities and do what we want. There's still, I believe, a massive underlying assumption amongst policymakers that that is what is happening. The reason we're stopping biodiversity loss is because we're not getting our sum quite right. So that's my experience of it. Not the only one, but my experience of it. Another area that I work within the framework of is placing economic value on biodiversity and ecosystems, trying to put some kind of number on what we value, whether it's recreational value, water purification, flooding prevention, carbon capture. And there are major academic, political frameworks based around this idea. So TEEB is an obvious one, the CBD report. Martin will know as well, we sit on the same forum in Europe, the European Habitats Forum, a coalition of NGOs, and we are bombarded with these assessments, requests to assess the suitability of these consultations about natural capital and green infrastructure. And the one that's flooding my inbox at the moment is biodiversity offsetting, which has been a big, the idea that you can, there's lots of elements to it, but the idea that if you want to build on a site and there's no other way of protecting it, you can somehow rebuild it somewhere else or enhance something slightly better. So you take one area and you move it somewhere else, or you enhance something. You have a direct transfer value of one site that's been lost for something else that could be replaced or enhanced. And there's a lot of debate for and against in the conservation and policy community about that. A very recent article by Georges Monbiot against this idea of valuing nature, costing nature. So people who think they're protecting nature by costing it are stepping straight into the destroyer's trap. And the argument he's using is, you can't win an argument unless you expound it in terms of your own values and reframe the issues around them. So costing nature tells us that it possesses no inherent value, that it's worthy of protection only when it performs services for us, that it is replaceable. And I have a lot of sympathy with this idea. And the idea of thinking behind it, But where I am at the moment is, how do I put this thinking into the professional work that I have? Because I do work in these international numbers, economics-based frameworks. How do I apply that policy, that philosophy in practice? That's where I'm at the moment. So I just want to say that even though I've talked about the negatives that I've encountered, they're not all negatives. I don't want to say that the top-down numerical-based frameworks are always bad. They're not always bad. There are good elements of them as well. And I just want to highlight two examples. My colleague Alan Hamilton has done a lot of work in this. He took the concept, the important plant areas, which was a top-down concept of conservation botanists saying, these are the priorities, this is what you need to protect, think about value, and saying, turning it on the side and saying, we're going to do it from medicinal plants point of view, because that's what the people who live there care about. They don't care about the 13 different subspecies of cudweed. They don't care, it's not in their value system, but they do care about the medicinal plants. But the areas that you're identifying for medicinal plants will also have other conservation value. So he's turning that top-down framework and trying to look at it from a different way. So it's not a well thought out academic thought, but this is where I'm at the moment, is what do I think are important about cultural values within conservation? I think it's all the discussions we've had are learning to accept that there are other points of view, other frameworks which are equally valid or can be more valid at certain times, trying to understand, get away from the top down on the conservation community's issues and priorities. And then in a very simple way, Virginia talked about an intellectual advocacy tool, which I like the idea of, because that's some of the areas I'm thinking about culture as well. So I want to go and talk about some examples I've been thinking about. And I've picked arable plants, because they are a very difficult group to think about in terms of conservation. In the last 50 years, they've become very highly threatened in the UK and Europe. They're not a pretty flower that grows at the top of a hill that everyone wants to conserve but has no direct conflict with your economic system. They are sometimes perceived in absolute direct conflict with food production. Some people would call them arable weeds. I call them arable plants. But there's a direct conflict with other people's agendas. Until recently, they've been very low on the conservation agenda. They're not quite wild enough. They're not quite native enough. They don't fit neatly into what we value in terms of rarity. They've come into the rarity value, but they didn't in the past. And the thing about this group of plants is they actually respond extremely well to conservation management techniques like agri-environments. But all these measures in the UK and Europe are voluntary. There is no top-down strategy from the agri-environment system, the agricultural system, that says your system, when you pay farmers, must achieve this outcome. It's entirely voluntary what farmers decide to do or don't decide to do. So, my colleague Kath Shelswell has been doing a lot of work on this for the last few years, both in terms of surveying arable plants, talking to farmers and convincing them or trying to persuade them or learning their views on whether they will or won't enter these agri-environment schemes. And I'm talking to her about why do any farmer in the UK or Europe enter into this scheme. In terms of legislation, the strong arm of the law is a tiny percentage. There's only 3 sites in the UK specifically designated for arable plants, and they're all nature reserves. So legislation is not the driving force in this. There's no compulsion in this. There are voluntary agri-environment schemes, 5 or 10 years, but what you get the cash equivalent of the crop that you forgo by having a larger margin. So it's you don't necessarily lose anything, but you don't win anything. So there's no economic incentive to take part in the scheme necessarily. What she found was, as well, some farmers were very interested, but they didn't want to be any part of any formal scheme at any level. They didn't want their site designated, they didn't want to enter an agri-environment scheme for their own reasons. And then some of the very unquantified personal reasons, that they're interested in what was on their farm. Sometimes it was rarity, sometimes it was wider biodiversity, sometimes it was pollinators. They had a range of issues about why they were or weren't interested in this. So the decision-making in UK farming, we have quite a lot of information on how particular species have reacted to being part of a scheme. the ecological conservation evidence about what's working, what's not working. What I say is we have very little evidence, even anecdotal evidence, for the decision-making process of the farmers who do or do not enter these schemes. As far as I know, they're not. No one is working on this to see why individual farmers make or do not make that decision. So the Kern couple, this is my particular cultural intellectual advocacy tool, and which I like for my own personal reasons in a way. I started off as an archaeobotanist, and this slide in the middle is what the seed looks like. It's incredibly easy to identify. Even on a wet Friday afternoon with a hangover, you will not miss a corncockle in your sample. It's very well recorded for that reason. It's incredibly rare. It's probably the rarest of the arable plants in the UK and Europe. It's almost extinct in farmland in the UK, and is declining in 25 out of 29 countries across Europe. And part of the reason is it sows itself with a seed. There's such good seed cleaning mechanisms that it never gets re-sown now. That's the reason why this particular plant is not around anymore. And the first records of it are in Iron Age Britain. Chaucer, Shakespeare, John Clare, William Morris use it because in the past it was such an important cultural plant. The majority of the population, or a large percentage, would have a connection with agriculture. They would understand this illusion. We completely do not understand the illusions they make now, because I've worked in conservation for 20 years. I have never seen a corncockle growing. So, and the reason that I think it's a cultural advocacy tool is because it's a loss of a living link with the spread of early farming cultures and our own farming heritage. So when we lose this plant, that's what we're losing. So this is I was thinking more about corncockles and the way Shakespeare uses them. He uses them as an illusion of rebellion, that Coriolanus says, we're nourishing these rebellious elements in our state, like cockles and corn. He's using it as the unruly element, the things that you can't control in life, that you would like to get rid of, but you can't do anything about. And I think two things about that. I think that we have now lost that cultural metaphor. There's nowhere you can stand in the UK and have the same experience as a Shakespearean audience or Coriolanus. You cannot stand in a cornfield and be surrounded by corncockles and know what he means. The other thing is, it's this element of it being a very difficult weed in some terms, in some cultural values, and it sounds on the face of it like a very good idea to get rid of it. And it, like all ideas about completely destroying something that you don't value or your enemies, it always sounds like a good idea, but it very rarely is. So we have very effectively got rid of most of the arable plants and our crops, but what have we lost and what have we gained in that process? And I like corncockle because it's difficult. It's difficult to argue for it. It's difficult to argue for it in contrast to food production, and it's also poisonous. It's not like it benignly sits there. It's poisonous as a contaminant. So I think it forces us to challenge our ethics and our practice about, do we only conserve the things that don't bother us, or do we care about the things that cause us trouble? I think it's an interesting intellectual problem. So the other one I wanted to look at was faith. None of these are threatened plants. There's no level of threat involved in any of these, but they're part of our living history. If you take a walk 5 minutes from here, you can take a walk through Christian tradition. So the sweet flag is probably the calamus of the Bible. So this is the plant that King Solomon imported to his temple. You can go and touch the same plant that King Solomon potentially touched. That's that living link with the past. It's imported to the UK, and Cardinal Wolsey, that was one of the reasons for his downfall, that he imported a sweet flag from Norfolk to London. That was a sign of his extravagance and a reason for getting rid of him. So it's a very strong cultural thing. The second one is the St John's wort, which in the face of it doesn't look terribly interesting importing. It's a medicinal plant, but can anyone think of any other plant in common usage in Britain that is named after a saint? In common usage or appears in her... there are none. I've been through them. Sorry?
Sapphire.
Oh, okay, we'll give you that one.
Not quite. Rosemary.
Oh, okay, right, okay, you're challenging me about it. Okay, but it's very... If you look at the early herbals and you look at what's now... St John's wort is practically the only one that survives with a saint's name. It's religious. It's not mentioned in the Bible, but we have called it in association with a Christian saint. And it's associated with St John's Day, Midsummer, And also the fern seed is another element around that very magical time, which is bound into Christian tradition as well. And the other element of that are the Mary flowers. This is Lady's Mantle. In the Jarrett Arbor is Our Lady's Mantle, very direct association with the Virgin Mary. And those get lost and become very generic Lady's Mantle. The Catholic tradition, the Mary tradition is lost in English. And I think there's a very interesting bit of research to be done in looking about the spread of written language and herbals and the change in these religious uses of names. Because the people who are printing the herbals, printing the first Bibles, are also printing herbals. There's a strong Protestant tradition in this written heritage, and I think that's a very interesting area to explore. However, in Gaelic, Gaelic and Welsh, these names do survive, with saints' names and Mary's names. And the St. John's wort in Gaelic, maybe William can do that one, the plant of the armpit of St. Columba, which is, sounds lovely in Gaelic, so. But it's surviving in that tradition. And this is the Mary Flowers altar in Clandaff in Wales. That's a very strong tradition in Wales that we have entirely lost in common English usage now. I don't know what the equivalent of iconoclasm, but the loss of names, eradication of a cultural connection through names. And the last bit I want to say about that is this is a late 16th century embroidery, probably by women, we don't know, in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And these are this is what the Garden of England looks like to this person. And there's some, you've got your, on the left, you've got your carnations, very high status Tudor and Stuart plants. And in the bottom, just below Adam, you've got what's probably the plantain, which is the plant that grows by the wayside. It shows you the correct way to go, the right path to go on to be a good Christian. And then a very nice element, which I found nowhere else, is a British bluebell, which of course is very directly located in Britain. You don't find it in other countries. So usually these books are done by pattern books. They're very formalised in a way, the plants that you will depict. So seeing a bluebell is actually quite rare because it's a very British plant. It's a very British tradition, so it's quite nice. And then when you see them being thrown out of the Garden of Eden, the plant symbolism is there as well. So you can see just below the angel, there's a thistle. That's the only plant mentioned in Genesis. When you leave this perfect garden, you'll go into a land of thistles and hardship, where any plant you touch will hurt you rather than help you. That symbolism is specifically stated in the Bible. And then a later one is next to Adam is a borage flower, which is a flower of courage. So it's very, very well known in Tudor and Stuart period. But it's imported. It's a Mediterranean tradition. We don't know how it gets here. It could be monasteries, it could be trade, it could be anything. But it becomes associated with the Crusades. Knights are given borage before they go on the Crusades. A plant of the Mediterranean, which also occurs in Arabic healing tradition, becomes an imported symbol of the Crusades. I think some very interesting stories about how we think about culture around this. So it's just a very quick run through of what I'm thinking. And the other thing I want to say is thinking about culture and cultural heritage and conservation does not necessarily mean believing in some bucolic golden age, some perfect landscape that must be preserved, that's being chipped away and eroded. It doesn't have to be like that at all. It can accept dynamic change as cultural tradition. Road verges are now our largest, most connected area of unimproved grasslands. Ecologically, they do the job that meadows used to do before we got rid of meadows. So they provide unimproved areas where rare plants grow and they're cut down. So in terms of influencing the spread of grass and plants, you have more chance influencing road verge policy than you do by recreating meadows. So I think that's quite an interesting way of looking at it. In terms of culture, the one on the left is a spiked rampion, the Rapunzel plant. We tried for years and years and years to get Hampshire County Council not to cut a road verge that had this on. Spiked rampion is very rare, it's very pretty, please don't cut it. When one of our team dug up that this is the Rapunzel plant, local press went mad. Now that verge is not cut. If it had been the lesser spotted cudweed, it would still be cut. But because it's the Rapunzel plant, it's not cut now. So, and then just some of this older tradition as well. The meadow sweet also grows at the side of roads. Meadows, people would walk past it without a second thought. It's got very, very deep cultural traditions in Gaelic and Welsh and Irish tradition, which we probably know less of than classical and Norse mythology in our country. I certainly did before I started this. So it's found in Bronze Age tombs, it's the plant of Cuchullin, it's a plant of Blodweth in Wales, It's a very important Bronze Age, Iron Age. And then by the time you get to the Victorian language of flowers, it's the plant of uselessness. It has no use for them. So they've just thrown up the scrap heap of history. So that's just some of the things. I don't want to talk too long, so I'm talking very briefly about this project I've been working on for 3 years now called Wildflower Europe. It's a consortium of conservation NGOs, tourism organisations, state municipalities and rural development organisations. The seven of us in five countries. And there are three elements: public participation artwork, wildflower festivals and community history archives. And this was a top-down structure imposed on us by the EU Culture Programme, and it forced us to think in ways we didn't want to think, but actually the constraints they placed on us produced a very interesting result, which we would never have come to if we'd been allowed to travel on our own track. So I would say sometimes top-down structures are creative experiences. This is a website. I don't have too much time, so have a look at the website, Wildflower Europe. So that's where it is. My colleague Beth, sitting in Salisbury, made this map, so Britain has number one for her own particular reasons, but that's where the countries are. And again, that's just something about it. It was developed in Slovenia, in Bochum, and they had the Wildflower Festival. They wanted to expand it, and that's what we came to discuss. Everyone wanted to do wildflower festivals, but the EU said we had to transfer artworks. So we spent ages grumbling about, oh, what are we going to do? We don't know anything about it. How do we do that? The artwork transfer part of the project became the most successful by a million miles. So be careful what you wish for. And this is the aims to re-inspire, very simple aims, re-inspire interest in beauty and culture for a wide audience, trying to find ways of mutual benefit for conservationists, local businesses, artists, trying to find where we have middle ground and we can all work together. And then creating public participation, work of art and community history for a long-term ability to inspire people, educate people that we've all created together. So this is going back to this idea of botany's monotony best left to one's aunt that we started with yesterday. I say the majority of people across Europe who took part in this, thousands of people took part in this across Europe from all ages. Youngest was 3, oldest was 90. That's our coordinator, Kleiman, and that's the president of Slovenia taking part very badly, but he took part. So just trying to, this is primarily, we had to find an artwork that was common to all our countries and that was portable and light and that anyone can take part on, which is why we came to embroidery. That's what we could all agree on. But since doing this project, I've learned lots about how second class botany and also textile art is viewed. So this is one I took on the website this morning. The Society of Wildlife Artists seeks submissions of work that depict wildlife subjects and evoke the spirit of the natural world. Conditions: domestic animals and botanical subjects are not admissible. When I read that sentence, is that famous discriminatory poster, no dogs and Irish. It's not only discriminatory, it's the order that you put it in. We are seen as below domestic animals and ability to inspire and enthuse about the natural world. So I think something should be done. I think I would like to write to them or maybe get some idea to explain themselves. Why are we so low down their list? And I think there's something to be seen there, done there. So we've had exhibitions of this work across Europe, Bulgaria, that's Salisbury, Scottish Parliament, Edinburgh Botanic Gardens, Slovenia, Ljubljana College of Art. All of these pictures are online, so you can see them at your... And these are some of the places where the wildflower festivals are. Oops. Again, so part of it was we had to transfer artworks, but we also had to transfer performers between countries as well. So musicians from Croatia went to Scotland, dancers from Romania went to Bulgaria. That was the idea imposed on us, but actually, in the end, we quite liked it. And this is an interesting project done by one of the coordinators in Slovenia. She got all the final year art fashion students in Ljubljana to design their final outfit based on a mountain alpine plant. They could do anything in any way, and then held fashion shows in Ljubljana and in the villages where the medals were. And it worked really well. It was a fantastic, again, we would never have come up with if it had been conservation organisations talking to conservation organisations, but it had much greater outreach to a different group of people that we would never have reached otherwise. And another part of this is Skillshare. This is the Ascent Fisherman's Mission up in Mackinver. And this is a community-driven project. They got some money for, I think it was a local developer. So it's a cafe, and on the top is a digital archive. So anyone in the village can come and input their information. There were their pictures, stories, and they have a structure. But they've used it as a training tool to engage older people with computer technology or younger people to learn about computers. But there's a lot of thinking going on behind this. They thought ethically about it as well. Anyone can go there and use it, but you have to go there. You can use it when you're in Lochinver, but you can't access it out of Lochinver. So if you want to use it, you have to go and spend money in their community, learn about their community, which I never even thought about before I started this project. So the man who set this up came to Bulgaria, and we all got together and decided different ways we thought this might be useful, and people liked it at different levels. The Bulgarians liked the idea of doing Flora Bulgarica, like Flora Celtica, sort of national level. Some of the other people who are based in one locality wanted to do community archives over a range of subjects, which could include botany landscapes. So some very interesting thinking going on there. The other thing that I'm doing a little project on at the moment is the Commonwealth Games comes to Glasgow in about 2 weeks' time. So as a continuation of this project, we've got a little bit of money to celebrate the national plants of the Commonwealth, which was and we're doing this, these are all done by primary school children, and just as a way of celebrating the diversity of people who will be coming to Scotland and the places that they have come from to get to Scotland. So it's and telling some of the stories about it is a way in for them to learn about other cultures, other places, and what they value. These are nationally defined plants, most of them, not all, but. And then this, the red royal poinciana, which is native to Madagascar, but it's the national plant of St. Kitts and Nevis in the Caribbean. It's very threatened in the wild, but it's spread over the world as cultivated plants. So even national plants, which you expect to be endemic, native, have some qualities, are often from other countries, which I find a very interesting process, which I've been learning about. And yes, so it's been fun. And very sore on the hand, threading needles for five-year-olds for months at a time. So, and I just want to finish this because it's getting late, it's lunchtime for the second day. A personal statement: I do my job because I find plants beautiful, interesting, and inspiring. And that's why I do what I do. Not for very many complicated academic reasons, that's why I do it. And I want to leave you some pictures that people have created across Europe. And so this last one here, this was done by the local librarian in the town where I live. She's never sewn before, but what she told me, that I didn't know that D.H. Lawrence trained as a botanist, and that was her interest. And the poem here is, even when everything's lost, in the time before hope, there's a tiny stillness that's the size of the eye of a violet. That's the idea of this hope, whatever else you represent. In all cultures, in all places, they represent some form of hope, of renewal, growth. I think that's what I want to say. You represent hope for lots of people. So thank you.